Okay, so I thought we'd start with a little quiz here. And there are three sets of people there. And I just wondered if anybody knew what those three sets of people have in common or would like to have a guess what those three people have in common. Any ideas? Anybody know who any of them are, even? No? Okay, I'm going to give you a little clue then. Okay. Yes, Alistair? That is fantastic. I am very, very impressed. So yes, they all had hits, which was called The Power of Love. And I think that's kind of what this passage is about. Okay, if we have a little look at what they said, Huey Lewis tells us the power of love is a curious thing. It's more than a feeling. Jennifer Rush, we're heading for something, somewhere I've never been. Sometimes I'm frightened, but I'm ready to learn the power of love. And Holly Johnson, in that famous sort of Christmas song, sings us that tells us it's a force from above cleaning my soul. And while they're clearly referring mainly to romantic love in these songs, so we can perceive that there is an element of spiritual truth in these lyrics. And after all, we are told in Genesis that we're all created in the image of God, and we have something of the divine in each one of us. When you read this very famous passage, one of the first things that you notice are the words love and power. And both of these words are mentioned three times in total during this passage, and they seem to be used almost in an intertwined kind of way. Now, most people, I think, don't have a problem with the word love. But I think a lot more people feel very uncomfortable about the word power. And in fact, you only have to look up on the internet quotes about power to discover this. And when I was younger and doing A-level history, I remember one of the essays I had to write was called Power Tends to Corrupt, and Absolute Power Corrupts Absolutely. Discuss. And in fact, this particular quote comes from this chap here. He was Lord Acton. He was a very famous historian that was around at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And to be honest, you only have to look at the world today to see how much that is true. I don't know whether anybody saw a couple of months ago, there was a series of three programs called Dangerous Dynasties, The House of Assad. And it was all about the Syrian conflict and basically explanation of how, in effect, a mild-mannered eye doctor who trained in London has in fact been now responsible for the killing of 500,000 Syrian people. And only this week, you might have heard, I think it was on Monday, there was something about Aung San Suu Kyi, who was imprisoned for a long time. And yet, Amnesty has just taken away her Ambassador of Conscience award because she's been implicated for not really speaking up about what's happened to the Rohingya Muslims, the persecution that there's been in Myanmar. However, I think we can say here that Paul is not talking about our power, but as it says in verse 20, it's his power, God's power, that is given to us, to our very inner being, through his spirit. That's what it says in verse 16. And this is at work within us. So it's as if Paul is saying that we're a bit like this torch here. Okay? We're like the light bulb in the torch. Okay? It won't work until it's intended to unless we use the power. So unless I actually switch on and connect with the, in this case, the battery that's in here. It won't work, and certainly when we were explaining electricity to children, we always explained that the battery was like this little sort of power pack of electricity. Now, electricity is dangerous, and for many of us, I think that accepting the gift of God's power can seem even more frightening and unpredictable. But here Paul is praying for the Ephesians that God will strengthen them by allowing his power to flow in and through them, because it's not simply human power, fallible power, but God's power, the power of his love. So why would Paul do this? Well, It seems as if this letter was partly written to the Ephesians and probably the other churches in the area, not because they had a specific problem that needed addressing in the same way that the Galatians did or the Corinthians did, but because they needed encouragement. And if you look back to the previous verse in chapter 3, Paul actually says, he asked them not to be discouraged because of his sufferings for them. Now, at this point, he was under house arrest in Rome and he was awaiting trial. And perhaps the Ephesians felt that in the same way that the disciples felt after Jesus had been crucified and before he had risen from the dead, perhaps they felt that the life of this person, Paul, who had brought them the good news and who they loved and looked up to and relied upon, was at stake. They appear to have felt very weak and very weary and powerless, and feelings which, to be honest, we know only too well as human beings. It's really easy and very human to be discouraged when times are hard, when we or those we love are suffering and we feel powerless. And I speak from personal experience. This year has probably been the worst year of my life. I have watched in disbelief as my family life has crumbled around me. At one point or another, every single member of my family has needed my support. It seems as if my life is the only life that's been untouched. Now, I don't watch EastEnders or any soaps like that, but to be honest, I have felt like I've been living in one of those television programs. And for some reason, the suffering and the need of those I love seems harder to bear as if it was just mine. Perhaps, maybe like the Ephesians, I was becoming a little bit complacent about my ability to manage on my own without plugging into God's power here. Perhaps I wasn't, as it says in the passage, sufficiently rooted and established in God's love. Perhaps I needed reminding, as only yesterday I read in Psalm 127, unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labour in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand watch in vain. It doesn't matter how much we toil and try, unless God is in it, we can't do anything. Now, of course, I, like you, have always been aware of God's power. There are very many references through the Bible, and we've just sung about it, in fact. But what Paul says just before he prays for the Ephesians is that his sufferings, far from being a source of discouragement, will actually be for their glory. Oops, sorry, that's it. There we go. In fact, he says a very similar thing to the Corinthians when he recounts the famous story of the thorn in his flesh. And he says there that his power is made perfect in weakness, and that when he is weak, then he is strong. He cannot rely on his own strength. He is being forced to rely on the power of God. And through this, he can be used more effectively than if he tries to do things in his own strength. Now, Dave spoke of the mystery of God a couple of weeks ago, and I have struggled for many, many years to try to understand why God allows suffering in the world. And I'm also not sure that I have quite reached the point of saying, as Paul does, that for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. I'm sure lots of us probably feel a little bit equivocal about that. Or even as James says in his letter, that I should consider it pure joy when I face trials. I think naturally, as human beings, we don't want to face trials. We don't want our life to be difficult. However, having said that, I think the events of the last year have actually brought me to a place where I can accept that, as it says in 1 Corinthians, now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. And it's given me a slightly better understanding of how God can be glorified by the power in his life, by his power in our lives, even in the most dark of times. What Paul prays for the Ephesians could equally apply to us here as a church. After all, in verse 14, Paul refers to the whole family of God. Are we as a church aware of God's presence, the power of his love in the busyness of our church activities or our daily lives? Or do we worry too much about the little details? In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells us not to worry about what to eat, what to drink, or what to wear, but to seek first his kingdom. Paul tells us that God wants us individually and as a church to know in a way that surpasses knowledge this loving power, this overflowing generosity. In John 10, verse 10, Jesus says he's come so we may have life and have life to the full. And I wonder if part of this mystery is more like the complete and utter trust of a child in its parents. Children have a total acceptance and belief in the power and love of their parents or the carers, their teachers. A belief that if you ask for bread, you will actually be given bread. In fact, sometimes you might be given something better than bread, like a Chelsea bun or croissant or something. Jesus tells us that God longs to give us good gifts. Gifts that, amongst others, include his power and his love. And frightening though it may be, we do need to allow God's power to work in and through us instead of trying to do things our own way, like a rebellious teenager. So, how can we understand this power more fully? If you read Ecclesiastes, it tells us in chapter 11 we cannot understand the work of God. And in many ways, I think it's clearly impossible for us to fully understand or grasp the power of God's love. Even Paul admits at the end of his prayer that God is able to do immeasurably more than we can ask or imagine. Now, unlike Dave, I'm not a scientist. I've got O-level biology, but that's about it. But obviously, as a primary school teacher, you do actually have to teach everything, and science is part of the national curriculum. And once a year, we had a science day, and this was a day when every teacher had to choose one experiment, and the idea was that groups of children would come round, and then they would do the experiment, and then they would feel amazed and have awe and wonder, and it would just be like, you would definitely get outstanding from Ofsted. So it was a bit like messy science, really. Now, I mean, I had several investigations that I used to like to do, but my favourite investigation on Science Day, which I used to do every few years, was called Does Water Have a Skin? Now, it was really interesting to hear what children thought about that, and of course, the first thing was that they said, no, it doesn't have a skin, because their knowledge of the concept of skin was very limited. It was, you know, it was this. And so, of course, they couldn't really compare this to water. However, after finding playing around with a lot of water and paper clips and sugar cubes, fairy liquid, and I don't know what else, they were really excited to be able to go home and to tell their parents that actually water does have a skin. And they could even prove it to them, very simply with just things at home. So the children's understanding of the concept of skin was suddenly much greater than it had been. Now, what I'm referring to, of course, is simply surface tension. Okay, and that you can show that just by pouring water into a glass, which I'm going to do right now just to show you. You just have to pretend that you're all about six now. So we can put the water in the cup, like this. And like Lisa showed with the children, you can actually measure that water in lots and lots of different ways. Okay? You can measure the height of it, the depth of it. You can measure the capacity of the glass. Okay? But what we need to grasp, I think, is that God's power is greater than this. So, if I try and pour a little bit more in, okay, you can see here that that water, this is where we've got the awe and wonder, okay, you can see there the water is just bulging up because that surface tension is just holding it in place. And I think that's a really good illustration of what God's power and love is. It's greater than what we can imagine. because you can see that that's bigger there. And I think, you know, you can see that even in the Old Testament, there are lots of references to this idea of a cup. I mean, most famously in Psalm 23, where it says, "My cup overflows." Or, in fact, if we return to the world of when you think I've loved you like I can, I'm going to love you a little bit more. So, let me encourage and challenge you this week. Go home and fill a glass of water really slowly. Watch it bulge up. Let it overflow. And then be really, really bold and ask God to completely fill you with his power and to do immeasurably more than you can imagine. And that is really scary, because power is really scary. And we don't know what might happen as a result of that. But we do know that we're asking him for his power, the power of love, not our own human fallible power. Paul tells us in Romans that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. Let's trust God and allow him to use his power and his love to transform us both as individuals and as a church, so that we may expect great things from him and do amazing things for him.